Personics, an introduction. Before we start, a quick note. This is a popular science introduction to the subject, made with the help of artificial intelligence. It's a first acquaintance, not a precise technical account, and not the last word. Anyone who wants the details and the exact wording will find them in the written pamphlet and in the white paper. Now, down to business. Think back to a time when someone wronged you and you knew you were right. Not suspected, knew. You had it in black and white. Paper, witnesses, a date. A neighbor moved your fence. A company never paid your invoice. An office wrecked half a year of your life with a stamp nobody wanted to sign. And you told yourself you wouldn't let it stand. That you'd fight back. You gathered your courage, wrote up what you had, and set out to claim justice. And then you hit a wall. Not the ill will of one person, a wall, a system that heard you out, nodded along, and then told you something that is stuck in your head to this day. It told you, yes, it's a wrong, but don't do anything about it, because otherwise you'll have an even bigger problem, with me. And you gave up. Almost everyone gives up in the end, not because they weren't right, but because the cost of being right had suddenly grown larger than the wrong itself. Justice turned out to be a luxury good, something you can afford only if you have enough money, enough time, enough nerve, and enough lawyers, and most people don't have all of that together, so they swallow it, turn around, and move on. And this is exactly the moment when the idea I'm going to tell you about is born. Notice one thing about that story. The state acknowledged the wrong. It didn't tell you you were mistaken. It told you that you were right, but advised you to keep your mouth shut. And whoever agrees with this logic, whoever accepts it as normal, becomes, according to the author of the idea we're unpacking here, something of an accomplice. Because the world works this way, in large part, only because we've gotten used to it. Because it seems normal to us that the rules are written by people who never live with their consequences. A politician who passes a law and is somewhere else within a year. A bureaucrat who issues a ruling and never meets the person that ruling was about. A whole layer of people whose only real qualification is that they know how to play the game and be pleasant, that they've mastered self-presentation. And meanwhile, all around us there are plenty of people who can look after themselves and their surroundings better than many an elected representative. It simply never occurred to them to sell themselves. So that's what the problem looks like. And now here comes the idea. Let me give it to you whole, in a single sentence, so you know where I'm headed, and then we'll take it apart slowly. Picture a reputation network. A network in which you make your own identity, out of your own keys, so that it belongs to no office and no company. It belongs to you alone. You get invited into the community by people who are already inside, and little by little, you build a reputation through what you do and what you can back up, and when a wrong is done to you, you won't go begging at a counter. You put forward what you have, the community takes a look, and it decides whether and how to act against the one who wronged you. It's nothing you have to hang on all day online, the way you do with a social network. It's a tool you reach for only when you need it. It sits in your pocket, and when a wrong comes, you pull it out. That's the whole thing. That's the idea at its core. Maybe it sounds too good. So I won't leave you with the feeling that it's just another utopia. Let's take apart what the whole thing stands on, and why it might actually work. The entire construction rests on five things. Let's call them five pillars, so we don't get lost. We'll go through them one by one, and you'll see that this isn't philosophy. It's more like engineering. The first pillar is voluntariness. Nobody forces you into the network. You don't have to walk in. You can live your whole life outside. But there's one catch, and it's only fair to say it straight out. Once you do walk in, you can't then erase your own deeds. You can't demand a right for the network to know nothing about you. Whether it holds records of how you behaved is up to you alone. It depends on how you behaved. Voluntariness here doesn't mean you get to pick only the pretty parts. It means that entry is free, but the consequences are real. The second pillar is organization. A single individual never changes the system on their own. That's also why every power, since the beginning of time, has watched one thing most closely: how people band together, whom it lets associate and whom it doesn't. The Personics idea answers this by having the community grow from the bottom up, from the people you know and trust, not from the top down, from whoever was assigned to you. And above all, those communities have to be handed real tools, so they don't just play at being a community, but can actually get something done. The third pillar is resilience. Sometimes it's called censorship resistance, but let's put it plainly. the path to change must not depend on whether someone up top lets you take it. If the tool could simply be switched off, someone would switch it off. So it has to be built such that the cost of silencing it is astronomical, so high that not even a state willing to pay for surveilling every single packet that flows across the network could manage it. Not that it will be hard to ban, it has to be practically impossible to fund. The fourth pillar is consensus, and this is where it gets interesting, because the solution itself has to contain a way to reach agreement, and at the same time, a way to force whoever breaks the agreement. Careful, this isn't about everybody nicely agreeing and everyone being happy. No win-win deal where we all smile and shake hands. This consensus arises through pressure, specifically, pressure on hypocrisy, and I'll explain how in a moment. Not through voting, not through a signature on some charter, through pressure. And the fifth pillar is incorruptibility. This is the second line of defense, and this one faces inward. The third pillar, resilience, protects the network from the outside, from the state, from a power that wants to silence it. But the network can also rot from within. Someone buys the people who are supposed to judge. And incorruptibility isn't one clever trick that solves it. It arises from the interplay of several principles that reinforce one another and that tangle corruption up in costs so high that it simply doesn't pay. Before we get into how the whole thing holds together, I have to put two things in your hands. Without them, one thing might keep nagging at you. Why would anyone believe what I write into that network? The first thing is identity. In that network, you make your own identity. Out of your own keys, not out of a document from some office. It belongs to no state and no company. It belongs to you alone, and you can have more than one. And onto this identity, claims accumulate over time. That you did honest work. That you kept your word. That you are who you are. This is called decentralized identity, or DID. Nobody issued it to you, and nobody can take it away. The second thing is how a claim gets into the network so that it carries any weight. And here we have to distinguish three different people, because each of them does something different. If you blur them together, none of it makes sense. The first one is you, the issuer, the one who wants to state something, that I delivered something, that someone treated me a certain way. You release the claim into the world. But your word alone isn't enough. If it were, anyone could write anything about anyone, and we'd be right back at social networks. So to your claim you bring a second person, an authority. That's someone trustworthy who backs up your claim. Either they examine your evidence and confirm it, this I've seen and it checks out, or they stake their own reputation outright and vouch for the truth of it with their name. Picture a notary whose entire livelihood stands or falls on what they've ever put their signature to. The authority is playing on your side. They lend your claim a piece of their reputation, and because they live off that reputation, they won't lend it lightly. And now the third one, and don't mistake this one for the authority, because it's an entirely different role, the verifier. This is the one who actually lets your claim into the network, or turns it away. And this person is not on your side, nor are they on the authority's side. They're impartial, and above all, you don't get to pick them. Who verifies your particular claim is decided by the network. A special function assigns them, for each individual claim, in such a way that the issuer has no way to reach in. And careful, don't take this for an ordinary lottery. It's not that you could keep trying until you happen to draw someone accommodating. Whoever the network assigns to your claim, that's who you go through it with. You don't choose them, you don't buy them, and you can't dodge them. They go by rules that are posted publicly in advance, and if they turn your claim away, that's not the end. You go to the next attempt, again with whoever the network assigns, but it costs more. And why this way? Why does the network assign the verifier and not you? Precisely so that no one can judge their own case. If you got to pick the verifier, you'd pick a crony, or you'd buy them, and impartiality would be gone. By having the network decide outside your control, that back door is closed. You've got an identity that belongs to you. You've got an authority you bring in so your claim is backed by their name. And you've got a verifier, impartial, assigned to your claim by the network, not by you. Now let's look at how something that holds together all on its own emerges from these pieces. This is the loveliest part of the whole idea, and I want you to understand it because once you do, everything else falls into place. The whole thing rests on one asymmetry, on an imbalance between how much it costs to read something and how much it costs to write something. Looking at someone's history in the network is nearly free, cheap, fast, available to everyone. but writing a new record, claiming something about someone, that costs you something, and provably so. Try looking at it this way. A reputation system is worth exactly as much as it costs to get a lie into it. When writing is free, the way we know it from social networks, it gets flooded with noise and nonsense. And anyone can write anything about anyone. When writing is expensive and verifiable, only what's reasonably accurate survives in it. And careful, not because people have suddenly become honest. People don't change. But because the price squeezes dishonesty out of that market. Lying simply stops paying off. And now watch out for one thing so you don't file it away wrong in your head. It's not the case that recording a wrong is cheap. That would be a dangerous mistake. Reading is cheap. Writing costs you verifiable effort. And that effort is exactly the safeguard against slander. The worse you can back up your claim, the more that record costs you. That's what keeps the whole network clean. That record you see costs you on three levels. It costs you time, because you have to wait for someone to verify your claim. It costs you energy because you have to assemble and sign a proper document. And it costs you money, because those who verify charge for it. And these three things can be traded off against one another in part. You can pay more and save time, you can spend more energy and save money. But there's one thing you can't buy, and that's reputation. Reputation you can't buy for any money. That you have to gather through your conduct over time, step by step. And it's precisely this one thing, that reputation can't be bought or gotten around, that makes the whole network resilient against a flood of fake identities. Anyone can spin up 1,000 new identities, but giving each of them a real history and a real reputation, that can't be faked in bulk. And here I have to add one thing quickly, so it doesn't come out wrong. When I say that writing costs something, it doesn't mean you're throwing that money out the window. Most of it, you see, comes back to you. Remember that the verifier isn't some outside institution, it's again someone from the community, and it could easily be you yourself. When you verify other people's claims, you get paid for it. And here's the point. Over the long run, for an honest and moderate person, it just about evens out. What you pay for your own records comes back to you as rewards for verifying others. Your truthful, useful claim thus comes close to a refundable deposit. You pay, but it comes back to you. All that's left is a small slice to keep the network running. A lie, on the other hand, or an empty, radical record, never comes back. That one is a pure loss. And from this follows a simple rule. You don't lose out when you go with the community. You lose out only when you go against it. So for an honest person claiming a real wrong, the cost of justice shrinks nearly to zero. Only the one who lies or exaggerates pays dearly. Let's go a bit deeper still, because here's the second stroke of genius. Who actually judges your claim? Who will the verifier be? Well, you can't guess it in advance. You can't buy it. Neither you nor any would-be attacker knows ahead of time whose willingness will even be needed. And now the best part. When one verifier turns your claim away, that doesn't mean it's over. It just means you try again, but more expensively. It sends you to the next attempt, to another verifier, again assigned to you by the network. And here's what you can call expensive radicalism. The wilder the thing you want to push through, the more it's going to cost you. It's made up of three costs that add up, and I'll tell you them because they're nicely vivid. The first is the number of attempts. A credible claim gets taken by the first or second verifier, and that's that. A problematic claim needs round after round after round, and each further round costs. The second cost is that the document swells. Every round glues on more metadata, so a claim that went through 20 rounds is 20 times bulkier than one that passed on the first try. And the third cost is a risk premium. A verifier willing to put their signature under something disputed charges more for it. For a credible claim, the base rate. For a controversial one, maybe triple. For a radical one, tenfold, and easily more. And this item doesn't grow slowly. This one shoots up. And now the most important sentence in this whole passage, so you don't misread me. This is not censorship. No claim in the network is forbidden. The system doesn't judge what's true. It prices risk. Even the most radical claim can go through and can be published. Only at a price that reflects how credible the network, taken as a whole, finds it. A true thing about how your neighbor moved your fence, you'll get through nearly for free. An outrageous lie that someone who simply rubs you the wrong way is a murderer, you can try to push that through too, but you'll pay so much for it that you'll think better of it. It's not a ban, it's a price. Tied to this is a figure it's worth picturing, because you'll need it. Picture the authority as a notary. A a notary whose entire livelihood stands or falls with their past. When they put their signature under a claim, they stake a piece of their own reputation on it. And now the numbers, because that's the beautiful part. Building reputation is slow. Say 2% up for one honest job. A step, a little step, a little step. But losing reputation, that's a catastrophe. Easily 70% down for a single untruth. Picture a notary like that, who over the years has built a reputation up to 85%. Someone comes to them and offers a bribe to sign something that isn't true. If they stay honest, they'll climb over time to 87. More clients will come, they can charge more. If they take the bribe and sign the lie, they drop to 15. 12 years of building a reputation, gone in a single afternoon. And we're not claiming this notary is a morally virtuous person. Not at all. We're claiming that corruption is priced so high that it simply doesn't fit into their own math. One fake job costs them more than 1,000 honest ones put together. To be precise about the math, for the bribe to pay off, it would have to outweigh what they're risking, and they're risking both. The chance of getting caught and how much reputation they lose if they get caught. The whole value of everything they've gathered so far. And because reputation can keep growing without limit, whereas a reasonable bribe has a ceiling, sooner or later corruption simply stops paying off for anyone. Here you see incorruptibility in action. It's not an appeal to conscience. It's accounting. Good. We have a network. We have reputation. We have verifiers. But what about it when the original wrong happens? What does justice look like without a judge, without a court, without a central authority to declare guilty or not guilty? And here we have to be honest about one uncomfortable thing we all carry inside us. People need to feel satisfaction. They need to see that whoever did the harm didn't get away with it. It's an almost dark need, but it's real, and whoever denies it is building on sand. If you look at history, how often was it really about whether the process was perfectly clean? It was about the fact that society needed to see someone punished. That signal to the rest of society, that the wrong didn't slide by, tends to matter more than the view of the victim themselves. Person X doesn't deny this dark need. It takes it and turns it into something useful. What actually is punishment? It's a form of humiliation of the one who did harm, through the loss of their privileges. So that the victim and those around feel that doing harm doesn't pay. It has two conditions. Harmful behavior must not pay off, and at the same time those who were wronged have to get that feeling of satisfaction. But how do you punish someone without a court and without constables? Like this. I can't lay a hand on someone else's property. That won't do and I don't want to. But I can publicly declare that I'll make my own property and my own holdings available only under certain conditions. That whoever behaved in a certain way must not come to me. I don't do business with them, I don't let them any closer. And it's public, deliberately public, so that others can see how I stand on it and can form their own opinion of me. And here comes the magical self-regulation through price, which you have to hear because it's the heart of the whole justice without a judge. Picture me starting to proclaim harsh punishments for utter trifles, that anyone who so much as looks at me askance is, to me, a criminal forever. What happens? The people around me start treating me as an unreasonable lunatic. Doing business with me becomes risky, because who knows when I'll get angry at them too. My costs for negotiating anything with anyone at all shoot up, and people start avoiding me, or they'll only do business with me on worse terms. Extremism prices itself. But careful, it works in the other direction too. If I'm overly lenient instead, if I tolerate people cheating me and just wave it off, that won't help me either. Those around me start seeing me as a risk, as someone who'll also be lenient toward those who harm them, and so they'll make me pay for it from the other side. Between these two edges, between insane harshness and boundless softness, there's some reasonable middle, and the price pushes you toward it all on its own. And this is exactly why the author says justice stops being a luxury good. Not that recording a wrong costs nothing, no, it costs verifiable effort precisely so the record means something. But it's affordable. That record is permanent, and the consequences are real, and that's the difference from today, when claiming your rights costs more than the wrong itself. There's one more subtlety the network can do and courts can't. It doesn't distinguish between whether you broke the law or whether you broke your own word. Both are equally readable signals to it. When I proclaim some rule somewhere, and then deviate from it myself, that gap shows up and it costs me something. Hypocrisy is expensive in this network, and that's something today's world can barely touch, because hypocrisy isn't a crime. and one more thing we're used to from the courtroom doesn't apply here. In court, guilt is one or zero, either guilty or not guilty. In this network, it isn't that binary. Here, it's about the accumulation of signals. A single unproven accusation of theft doesn't trigger condemnation of the accused. Rather, it triggers wariness toward the accuser. Aha! Someone here is pointing a finger at someone. Let's take a look at who's doing the pointing. Only when more independent indicators come in, from different sources that aren't in cahoots, only then does it carry weight. What decides is whether those witnesses are independent of one another, whether the pattern fits, whether it lines up in time. And when someone repeatedly points a finger at someone for no reason, it gets assessed as slander, and it's their own reputation that pays. The liar doesn't harm the victim. They harm themselves. And then there's atonement, which is a beautiful human thing. When the one who did harm takes a step towards setting it right of their own accord, before anything is even proven, they open a path to gentler treatment. Punishment lands in full only on the one who does nothing and just hopes to get away with it. A bit like when in today's system, someone counts on sweeping the guilt under the rug or on outright buying it away. Not here. Here it pays to take that step. And now something that's terribly important, so you can see this isn't about playing sheriff. You don't have to carry out that punishment personally. Not at all. You can delegate it, exactly the way you pay for insurance. You pay an authority that specializes in enforcement and that does it by rules laid down in advance. Something like today's investigators, law enforcement services and courts rolled into one, but on a market, not in a monopoly. And when such an authority enforces disproportionately, or on the contrary doesn't enforce at all, its reputation suffers. And because it too lives off its reputation, it can't afford that. This delegation is really a general principle of the whole network. Anything you can hand over to a specialist and take back at any time. That lets you draw on experts without losing final control over your own affair. And as a bonus, what today only banks and big players can do, sizing up in advance whom they're dealing with and how risky it is, would suddenly become available to absolutely everyone. Someone would, for a small fee, prepare a readable summary of the other party, tailored to whatever interests you. Good, all this sounds nice in theory, but how on earth do we get there from what we have now? Here I have to stress one word that is absolutely central to all of Personix. That word is evolution, not revolution. Evolution. No overthrow, no barricades, no night of the long knives. Always stirs up resistance and shatters the bonds people cling to because they know them. People instinctively protect what they have, even when it isn't perfect. So the transition has to be gradual, and above all of a kind that the old system can't switch off with a single button. Because if it could, it would be switched off at once. The best image for it is a bridge. Picture a river, and on it an old ferry, by which people have always been carried across. And beside that ferry you build a bridge. You don't forbid anyone the ferry. Let it run as long as it wants. But over time, people cross to the bridge of their own accord. Because it's more convenient, faster, and it pays off for them. Nobody forces them. They cross because they want to. And that's exactly how to picture the whole transition to Personix. You build a new layer on top of the old system. A layer that gradually turns it into a smaller and smaller part of itself. At the start, the new layer almost blends into the old world, but as time runs on, people shift over. Companies do this routinely. They build a parallel system and slowly move their customers onto it. The one thing you have to watch out for with extreme care is not to trigger that violent revolution, because that would destroy everything. And why money of all things? Why run the whole thing through money? Because the state at its core is a flow of money. Through money it pays for its coercive apparatus, that last link that physically enforces the rules. Without money, there is no monopoly on violence. When money starts to jam up, the state retreats, because it has nothing to pay the ones who keep it alive. And money has one exceptional property. Pressure on it can be applied voluntarily, peacefully, and transparently. You don't have to threaten anyone. You don't have to blow anything up. That would be terrorism, and Personix distances itself from that hard. It's enough for money to start flowing a different way, and for this, Personix has four tools that prop one another up. None of them is enough on its own, but together they hold like a wall. Let's take them in order. The first is a completely simple tax system, and it serves as the entry lure. One single rate on all income. No exemptions, no tax holidays, no corporate deductions, no perks for friends. one sentence instead of thousands of pages of laws that nobody understands anyway. And because every payment is verifiably tied to the identity that made it, oversight is trivial. And now the trick. That rate is set a touch more favorably than what you pay in the old system. So you have a reason to walk in, and what's more, that burden falls year by year, so the new system grows ever more tempting, and people move into it ever faster. The second tool is maybe the wittiest thing in all of Personics. It's called the Electronic Register of Expenditures, but you'll grasp the gist right away. Remember those receipts tracking schemes some governments run, where every sale is reported to the tax office the moment it happens? Back then, the state watched every sale of every tradesperson, because it started from the assumption that each of us is robbing it. Well, this is exactly that, but flipped upside down. Now, it's not us watching the tradesperson. Now it's us watching every single expenditure of the state. The state doesn't get a single coin for any payment until that payment passes through this sieve. For every expenditure, it has to say who it goes to, why it goes, and what for. And the result is raw public data that anyone can look into and analyze for themselves. What the oversight offices couldn't manage in years of work is suddenly one click away. And you don't even have to switch to the new tax system for it. It's enough that with every tracked payment you put down a small refundable deposit, say, a few euros, and when everything's in order, you get it back. It serves only as a filter against spam, so nobody floods the system with a million nonsense records. And that record can be entered by anyone. A grandson on behalf of his infirm grandfather. A neighbor whose town hasn't fixed the broken sidewalk in years. An entrepreneur whom the state never paid an invoice. A clerk who's simply exporting data. And you know what happens to the political parties? They transform. From recipients of money out of our taxes, they become providers of analysis. Instead of living off contributions, they'll offer their supporters overviews of whose expenditures are in order and whose aren't. And sloppy or nonsensical state expenditures automatically become the first candidates for the axe. The lovely punchline is that those schemes once told us, we assume every one of you is cheating us. This is the same logic, only flipped. Now the state has to prove itself to the citizens. And as the author says, if the dark side didn't hesitate to watch us like that, why should we hesitate to watch it? The third tool gives all of this teeth. It's the option for you to decide about part of your own taxes yourself. In the first round, the state gets its money regardless. But in the second round, no longer. In the second round, it's that first round analysis that decides. A small percentage of your taxes you steer yourself, wherever you want, provided your identity meets a few conditions. Say, that you're a real citizen and an adult. And this percentage grows year by year, maybe from 5% today to tens of percent in 10 years. And now realize what that means. The political fight shifts. It's no longer just about tossing a slip into a ballot box once every 4 years, and then watching for 4 years what they did with it. Suddenly you decide every year, with concrete sums, where your money flows, and careful, you're not dodging taxes. You pay them in full. You just steer them yourself. And the fourth tool is the lever that binds it all together, and only thanks to it does this become a real force. It's a negotiating platform with the state. It works like this. The state gets its money, so to speak, at the very last moment, only when it meets the conditions of transparency, when it correctly matches and documents the expenditure, and in the network a kind of waiting list forms of people willing to take part, and once that group swells to an economically significant size, so large that it could threaten even the growth of the whole economy, that's when it activates. That's when civil disobedience becomes a credible threat, not just a gesture by a few enthusiasts. First, where it has an easy defense, and where no savings can be found, the problematic payments, the ones tied to corruption, those it'll hold on to longest. But the mounting pressure will in the end force it to retreat from every position. And tied to this is one gorgeous thing. Citizenship without an ID card. The moment you have your own identity, when you vouch for yourself, that state-issued document loses its monopoly. You don't need a paper from an office to prove who you are. You have a whole range of your own identities, and some of them carry verifiable, permanent claims. That you're a citizen of this country, that you live in this town, that you graduated from this school, and that verifying is taken over by market authorities, notaries, local communities, employers, who vouch with their reputation that the identity belongs to you. And those details get verified across the network a second time, a third, a fourth, and from this follows one enormous thing. who belongs to the community is no longer decided by a clerk at a desk. It's decided by the community itself, through those reputation signals. And now I'm expecting an objection, because it's the smartest objection you can raise against this, and it deserves an honest answer. The objection goes like this. You're replacing the market here with some reputation points. You're introducing another system, where instead of prices, you tally up some grades for behavior. And this is exactly what every planned economy ran aground on. Without a market, and without prices, you can't calculate anything. It's a dead end. It's just another utopia of clever minds who think they'll outsmart reality. Right, this objection is serious, and I'll tell you straight away that it's mistaken. But not because those old economists who warned against planning weren't right. They were right. It's mistaken because Persinix doesn't do what they criticized. Listen closely because this is important. Persinix doesn't abolish the market. It doesn't abolish prices. It lets prices do exactly what they're good at. What it does is extend market calculation into an area where today there's no measurement at all. The classic argument against planning says that without prices you don't know how much of what to produce and what's scarce and what isn't, because prices are the signal that carries the dispersed knowledge of millions of people. And that still holds. Persinix doesn't touch it. Persinix merely adds, alongside the price, a second signal. A signal about how risky the person you want to do business with is, how reliable. The price tells you how much the thing costs, but it doesn't tell you whether the other party will even deliver it, or whether they'll swindle you. And this second signal was missing here, or existed only in forms that merely confirmed that criticism. Because this risk is measured today too, but how? The state does it through its registers, except those are slow and can be censored. The banks have their scores, except that's a closed monopoly you can't see into. Platforms like various marketplaces or carriers have stars and ratings, except you can't carry those with you when you leave for somewhere else. A neighbor's recommendation works, but it doesn't scale beyond the edge of the village. And all these ways suffer from the same disease. One side knows more than the other. Economists call it the market for lemons, after used cars. When the buyer can't tell a good car from a dud, they start to be safe, offering an average price. Except at an average price, the honest seller of a good car doesn't want to sell, so they leave, and only the duds are left on the market. This disease destroys trust everywhere around us. And against this, Persinix sets a second signal, one that's publicly verifiable, expensive to fake, and cheap to verify. So to sum up, we're not doing away with economic calculation. We're merely taking the monopoly off the infrastructure that lets you calculate the other party's risk. The reputation network makes the market mechanism more complete, not more marginal. And there's one limit I have to admit honestly, because without it, I'd be lying to you. Reputation doesn't replace prices. It doesn't replace the price of labor, the price of materials, the price of capital. That old argument about prices still holds. And Persinix doesn't quarrel with it. Reputation is only a supplement, a signal for one single dimension that price on its own never gave, and that's the reliability of the other party. And just as an aside, this isn't even science fiction. Reputation networks worked in history. Medieval merchants who traded at a distance across the whole Mediterranean, without a single shared court, held that entire system together thanks solely to verifiable reputation. And it worked for generations. And here I have to hit the brakes and say something that maybe isn't expected, but it's been in Persinix from the start, and it's what won me over about it. This is not a savior. It's not a miracle. It's a tool. And like every tool, it can fail, it can be used badly, and it solves nothing on its own. The author of the idea says it without wrapping. There's most likely no path on which someone else cleans up today's mess for you. No hero rides in on a white horse. No single button, no single leader, no single app fixes it. Persinix offers a way out of the trap, but the work will have to be done by people, you, us. And there's one more humility in it that I value, humility about the future. The author is very sure about how the world works today, how money works, how power works, how people work, that he's got mapped out and defended. But he's very cautious about what will come. He doesn't claim this particular path is the one correct or best one. He claims only that it seems coherent and that it has one enormous advantage. You can back out of it. And that's maybe the most important thing you should take away from today's talk. That reversibility. Every step can be undone. Because the new system at the start only overlaps the old and changes only the incentives, only what pays off for whom. Gradually the old one shrinks, but it doesn't vanish overnight, and in theory it may never have to vanish. And if a flaw in the design turned up anywhere, it's not the end of the world. It's not a catastrophe with no return. It's just a fix. You step back, correct it, and move on. No bridges burned. And this is exactly what makes revolution so dangerous. With a revolution, there's no way back. When it breaks entirely, and people die. Not here. When an edge case requires the state to still step in and hold something up, then it simply steps in. Some things, you see, don't have to have a market substitute. National defense, for instance. And even if it were ever necessary in a crisis to hand over extraordinary powers, the way the old Romans once appointed a dictator for a few months, even that option can remain. Just with the difference that responsibility lies with the whole decentralized society, not with one leader, and those handed over powers can be taken back far more easily once the danger has passed. Right. That's Persinix in a nutshell, at least the first glance, the first layer. Let's pull it down to what you should remember if you forget everything else. We live in a system where the people who write the rules never live with their consequences, where the state will readily grant that you're right and still advise you to stay silent, where justice is a luxury good for those who can afford it. And Persinix is an attempt to flip this, to build, beside the old world, a new layer in which you have your own identity that no one can take from you, where you build a reputation through what you do, where lying doesn't pay, not because of morals, but because of price, where a wrong can be backed up so that it means something, even though that record costs honest effort, and where the whole change is reached slowly, voluntarily, and in a way you can step back from at every step. And now the most important thing, the reason I actually put this whole talk together. I'm not asking you to believe it. Not at all. Belief is the last thing this idea needs. I'm asking you for something else. That it stay lodged in your head. That you think about it, and above all, that you try to break it. To find the hole, the spot where it doesn't make sense. The crack in the design that I may be hid from you here, or that I don't even know about myself. Because that's exactly what this idea needs most. Not admirers. It needs people who dig into it and honestly try to refute it. If it holds up, it's stronger. If it doesn't, it gets fixed, or it gets thrown out. That's how it should be. So take this very last question and keep it in your head after you switch off this audio. Think back to the last wrong you'd rather have swallowed, the one where you knew you were right and still couldn't do a thing about it. How much would it have cost you to claim your due? And if there were a way out here, that layer beside the old world, where standing up for yourself wouldn't cost more than the wrong itself. What would you do with it? What would you add? What would you fix? Where would you start? Because if this idea is ever to come alive, it won't be because someone applauds it. It'll be because people like you dig into it. So it's your turn. And if this grabbed you even a little, if you feel like following the idea further, wrestling with it, and seeing where it goes, subscribe so you don't miss what comes next. And right at the end, this was only a first acquaintance. A view from above. Almost everything I talked about, the pamphlet and the white paper unpack far more deeply, and plenty more didn't fit in here at all. So if it grabbed you, here's a taste of what's waiting for you there. I'll start with how it works under the hood. You'll learn how, exactly the math arranges it so that you can't pick, or guess in advance, who'll judge your claim. And all of that with no central server and no blockchain. Which four gates your claim passes through, before someone lets it in, or prices it up. You'll find there the cleverest trick of the whole network, how to force it into honesty using watchdogs that don't even have to be real. What concrete technology stands behind the fact that the network can't be switched off, whatever the state spends on it? And how you can even guarantee that a digital record corresponds to what really happened, a problem the entire crypto world is grappling with. Then there's resilience and privacy. How the network defends itself against thousands of fake identities, and why not even a rich man can buy a whole community. How it really stands with your privacy, whether you can take a new name and start from scratch, and what can and can't be hidden. How several separate identities can protect you if you live where the truth is dangerous, and that the network has a built-in knob between freedom and control. One that you, they don't turn yourself, your community does. Then the things around justice that go further. How out of thousands of personal rules, a social contract arises that nobody wrote or signed. Who can stand up for you when you can't defend yourself? By what exact criteria the network tells a credible accusation, from coincidence or from slander? and how influence based on position and connections would turn into influence based on what a person demonstrably can do. And then the sharpest things, the ones the authors don't dodge. Why a few percent of inflation you barely notice is quietly robbing you and tethering you to the state. And why they speak of the collapse of the biggest pyramid scheme in history, the pay-as-you-go pension system, as a clock ticking beside the whole project. And finally, the thing I value most of all about this. The authors themselves point out the weaknesses of their own design. The cold start problem, the risk that the costs shut out precisely the poorest with grievances, and the open question of what happens once lies start to be written by machines instead of people. You'll also find hard math there, which turns those principles into numbers and precise formulas, not just a story. And you'll learn what their next step is, the one with which they mean to put the whole idea to the test, or, just as readily, to bury it. All of that and much more, you'll find in the Personix pamphlet and white paper.